My name is David Clough. I'm the president of the Society for the Study of Christian Ethics, and so it's my great pleasure and responsibility to give you a very warm welcome to the beginning of our 2015 annual conference. I want especially to give you a warm welcome if this is your first time at the conference. We very much hope that you find the conference a place of welcome, that you enjoy your time here, that you are able to engage in conversation with perhaps in a conference of this size most of the attendees before you leave. And if you do have any concerns at any point, do come and talk to me or Jeremy, who the secretary, will be introducing himself in just a moment. We want to make sure you're having a happy time. We also want hope that you will find this a place of serious academic inquiry in touch with serious and pressing moral challenges of our day. We're addressing together a very serious topic of ethical interest, one that we see the implications of everywhere. It's obviously part of the material of considering the operation of power and its limits to see the people that are being spewed out of Syria and the challenge that that's placing on the European community at this time. And obviously there are any number of other really serious, pressing, current challenges that are behind the topic of our conference. So I hope, as well as you finding this a place of friendship and welcome, that you find this as a place where your thoughts are stimulated and you go out able to continue to engage in those serious topics of concern. There's just one piece of informal business before I hand you over to Jeremy as secretary. A past president of the society, and a great servant of it, I've discovered, is celebrating a very significant birthday today. Susan Parsons, who, and I wondered if, just at this moment of opening, we might welcome Susan by singing her happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. I'll hand over to Jeremy, the Secretary of the Study of Christian Ethics, who's most of you have already been in touch with, and whose labours on behalf of us all are immense. Thanks, Jeremy.
Delighted to see a full room. You've all made it here safely. I'm very pleased to see that. Let me just point out one other person first. Kevin, where are you? There he is. Kevin should be your first line of defense. He is our conference secretary. Not only is he indispensable, but he's quite a lot more organized and efficient than I am. So you should also look to Kevin if you have questions. You're stuck, you're locked out of your room. Either of us can help you. We're delighted to be here to help make your conference smooth and enjoyable. I've just got a few little announcements. I'll be peppering you with announcements throughout the weekend. Most of them will be most of you can stop listening right now and you can really sink in when William starts in a few moments. But for dinner, which we'll be going to after this, quite a lot of you have specified some form of dietary preference. And because there's quite a lot of you, you shouldn't feel ashamed to go up to the line and specify your preference before you take it. It's going to be served buffet style tonight. So you'll line up and just say, I'm a vegetarian and I'm proud. That'll give you what you're looking for. We've done Susan's birthday. I think Susan was expecting something. I tried to slip it in an unexpected way, I hope. We might just have celebration throughout the evening. Fire evacuation. In the occasion that we have a fire, the evacuation place is the parking lot. It's just through, there's a little archway right over here. There's a garden and a parking lot. If you're on that side of the building, you file out through the archway into the parking lot. If you're on this side of the building, you go out the arches and then down the street and around into it. I'll probably nominate some people to shout loudly and lead you if you need it, if you're feeling disoriented in the middle of the night. There are no fire drills planned, as I understand it, for the weekend, so if the alarms go, then we can file in an orderly way and save ourselves. I think that's all except for one last thing. One of the things you'll notice as you go through the AGM and listen maybe to what some of the other committee members have to say, we're trying to add little bits of spice here and there to the proceedings. So one of them pertains to the Q&A, which we'll have after this plenary. Standard practice is to stand and deliver, orate your question, but we've found that there are some members of society who aren't as excited about standing and delivering, or maybe just don't have time to get their questions in. So we're going to invite questions into alternative formats, and this is why I've given you a slide up here. We're going to invite you to tweet a question. We have our own Twitter account, I'm proud to say, but we also have an email address. So if you'd like, at the end of the lecture, or perhaps as it goes along, and you have a question you'd like to put to our speaker, send your question through one of those two formats, if you'd like. I probably won't pass them all along, so that's not a guarantee that you get an answer, but it does mean that I'll have a chance to pass it along at some point as we get through the Q&A. We'll see how that goes as the conference goes along, and that's all I have for now, so I'll pass it back to you.
It's a real pleasure to introduce William Spiker as our first plenary speaker for the conference this year. Bill has an MDiv from Duke and a PhD from the University of Chicago, and he's now Edward L. Ryerson Distinguished Service Professor of Theological Ethics at the University of Chicago and has taught there since 1989. He's an ordained minister of United Methodist Church, and in the year 2015 to 2016, he's the president of the Society of Christian Ethics, which is our much larger sibling, the other side of the Atlantic, has an annual conference in January, which some of us have attended and enjoyed. Bill is the author of a large number of books, many of which members of this society will be familiar with: Responsibility and Christian Ethics in 1995, Power, Value and Conviction, particularly pertaining to our conference title, Theological Ethics in the Postmodern Age, 1998, Theological Ethics and Global Dynamics in 2004, Religion and the Human Future with David Clem in 2008, and I love this title, Bill, Dust That Breathes, Christian Faith and New Humanisms in 2010. You may also have recognised his name from his editorship of the Blackwell Companion to Christian Ethics. But I particularly wanted to emphasise his role as president of the Society of Christian Ethics. We're trying to develop stronger links with our sister societies, the SCE and Societas Ethica, the Continental European Society. And so it's a really great thing for us to be able to welcome Bill in his presidential year to address us. And please welcome him with me.
Well, I want to thank President David Clough, the organizers of this conference, and members of the Society for the Study of Christian Ethics for the kind invitation to give this lecture. It's a real honor for me to be here today, and I'm happy to bring the greetings from the Society of Christian Ethics, as you've already heard, your sister society on the other side of the pond. As the current president of the SCE, the theme that I have chosen for our annual meeting in January 2016 in Toronto, Canada, is Humanity and the Global Future. We would be honored if any of the members of the SSCE could join us for that conference. But in any case, thank you for having me here. It is also, I must say, a special joy and honor for me to be asked to present a lecture at this event and thereby to acknowledge the 8th centenary of the issuing of the Magna Carta, as well as the democratic movements it spawned around the world. Given this, I've given my title for this lecture, The Ethical Limits of Power on the Perichoresis of Power. Let me begin by clarifying the direction and method of the lecture so that you'll have some sense of the steps of the argument. Well, the topic of this conference is notoriously complicated and one fraught with debates on all sides, even about the basic meaning of terms. The struggle or compromise between the titanic forces of religion and politics too readily expose the weakness of moral claims about what is good, just, and right. Alfred North Whitehead once stated in his volume, The Adventures of Ideas, that, quote, human civilization is the victory of persuasion over force, unquote. On that account, we must see, civilization is a tenuous and very fragile moral reality. Let's begin then by clarifying some terms. By power, I mean the capacity to respond to, shape, or create reality. Power can be augmented by the increase of any of those capacities. For instance, the greater the capacity to respond to reality, the greater the power, as process theologians have long argued about the consequent nature of God. And that would be true also of the other capacities, that is, to shape or to create reality. To be sure, power can be legitimated in various ways, so people often talk about power over or power to or power with, but for the moment, let my definition stand. My concern is how religious, political, and moral powers are distinct forms of power. The Greek term perichoresis literally means rotation, and it has been used throughout the history of Christian thought to speak about the relations among the persons of the divine Trinity, three persons in one substance, as the classical formulation had it. My claim is that power, theologically considered, also has this complex dynamic tracing of the interconnections between the forms of power we're looking at, religious, moral, and political. And just as the Church Fathers struggled to distinguish without separating Father, Son, Holy Spirit by specifying the distinctiveness of the divine purposes, persons, so too I will be struggling to relate and yet also to distinguish the threefold dynamics of power. I'm engaged then in a form of hermeneutical reflection that deploys the metaphorical potential of a concept, perichoresis, in order to articulate and to interpret power and its limits. Now, I hasten to add three caveats at the beginning of this lecture. First, I am not claiming a causal relation between the perichoresis of the divine power and the divine Godhead. Thus, I'm not saying either that a conception of the Godhead was the cause of a conception of power, or that a conception of power dictated a triune conception of God. I don't see how one could draw that causal relations without massive, detailed, and finally, probably fruitless historical inquiry. My claim is much simpler. That is, I'm making an analogy, a similarity in difference between theological conceptions of power and beliefs about the Godhead. Second, I am not seeking to line up the persons of the Trinity and ideas about power, as if, for example, the Holy Spirit is about political power, while the Son is the grounds of ethical power and the Father accords with divine power. Such parallels are overly wooden, and they paralyze constructive theological reflection. Third, and finally, I am also not trying to re-mythologize the world, as some theologians claim to be doing. I understand the intention of theological thinking to be the articulation and interpretation of the structures of lived reality in order to orient personal and social life. Its job is not to draw all reality within the Christian symbol system. In saying this, I agree with Henry Nelson Wyman, an early 20th century theologian in Chicago, who once said, quote, "We live deeper than we think," thinking, including theological thinking, is, on my account, trying to articulate and interpret the complexities of life, because it is life, including divine life, that matters, and not the treasures of the Christian symbol system, which, if truth be told, too often have become idols of thought and practice. My point, then, in examining power on analogy to the perichoresis of the Godhead is to claim that an adequate Christian conception of power cannot privilege one form of power, but must think within the multidimensional dynamics of moral, political, and religious power. Not only is this the case if we want to understand so-called pre-modern societies, which lack the systematic differentiation of the social system into various subsystems like economics, politics, media, education, and the like. That is, pre-modern societies, as Nicholas Luhmann, Max Weber, and others have noted, are undifferentiated. They have coherence through the domination of one value system and its communication media, say, religious rituals. God and king are, therefore, often situated within the same social code of communication. In terms of the history of religions, then, these are pre-axial forms of religion. Modern differentiated societies arising out of the axial religions must be understood through the reflexive dynamic endemic to differentiated social systems. That is, how, say, economics helps to shape and yet is also shaped by political rationality, or the ways in which politics drives media, and vice versa. Differentiated societies, and this is important to my argument here, because I'm starting to draw some of the analogy between the divine and societies. Differentiated societies do not need one unifying code. And in fact, they are destroyed through the imposition of one social code. One sees this, for instance, in the fate of totalitarian states, but also in tribal nation states. The attempt to impose one form on differentiated societies lead to their ruin. This has real implications for how we think about the relation, for instance, of politics and economics, but I won't go there right now. Now, how am I going to make this argument? My tactic of reflection is a rather classical one. The philosopher Susan Wolfe has noted, quote, "Aristotle is well known for his use of the endoxic method in defending moral and conceptual claims. That is, he takes the endoxae, the things which are accepted by everyone, or by most people, or by the wise, as the starting point in his inquiries." Interestingly enough, St. Augustine, in texts like On the Morals of the Catholic Church and also The City of God, adopts that method and then gives it a crucial theological twist that I also want to practice. That is, Augustine begins by bracketing distinctively Christian claims and examines the endoxae about the human good or about justice. But as the argument proceeds, he removes the brackets and shows the indispensable contribution Christian convictions can make to that shared topic of inquiry. For the purposes of this lecture, then, I want to explore some expressions of the endoxe, the widely accepted beliefs about power and its limits, in order to finally make a theological contribution. So I'll be lifting the brackets as we proceed through this, but we're starting by first of all bracketing distinctively Christian claims. By exploring the endoxe about power and its limits, as well as the metaphorical potential of perichoresis, I aim to show the indispensable contribution that Christian thinking can make to our shared moral challenges around power. So let me begin then by clarifying the endoxe about power. We all know that politics and political power has been variously defined, both in history and in contemporary discourse, Rousseau in his Social Contract wrote this, quote, "At first, men had no kings but the gods, and their only government was theocratic. From this simple fact that a god was placed at the head of every political society, it follows that there are as many gods as peoples," unquote. That is to say, from the dawn of Western history at least two accepted beliefs about power and their relations have shaped political, religious, and moral thinking in pre-axial societies. First, political power has often been identified with a divine source, such that kings were either established by God, as even St. Paul puts it in Romans 13, or they mediated divine power to the social order. Of course, one could, like Aristotle in the Politics and others did, explore various forms of power or constitutions of legitimate political power, but conceptions of power qua power were rooted, on this first line of argument, in the divine. The second rooting of power is in terms of nature, as we find it, for instance, Callicles arguing in Plato's Gorgias, or Nietzsche in On the Morals of the Genealogy of Morals. The belief here, supposedly rooted in nature, is that the strong do and should dominate the weak. This naturalistic idea of power is expressed in domination and is therefore void of any ethical or religious limits. This idea reaches back behind Plato's attempt to secure ethical limits on power. Thucydides, in the history of the Peloponnesian Wars, for instance, begins the legacy of political realism, which argues that in relations among people, power must meet power, and that common cause is found not in shared interests, nor in shared overarching principles, but in the struggle of each against each. One could see the Magna Carta itself as the attempt to find a resolution of clashing powers through a contract built on interests. Certainly Thomas Hobbes, the father of modern political realism, held that it was a rational decision by individuals to forfeit the natural right of power over others to an absolute sovereign in seeking security from the threat of violent death amid the war of each against each, as he defined the state of nature. Now, my point here is conceptual and not historical. Namely, that when in the history of Western thought the source of power is thought about in terms of nature, either might makes right, or one must find some other way, say through social contracts, an absolute sovereign, or the gods, to place limits on power. In this respect, the first dominant endoxe about political power, the theological one, is layered over the idea that might makes right by having God as the source of power, delegating it to his representatives, to a king, as Rousseau noted. Importantly, the question of God and political power becomes much more complex if we turn to the axial religions. As the sociologist Robert Bella has noted, with the axial religions, there emerged a distinctly moral criticism of sacred and kingly power that manifested a second-order thinking, that is, a thinking about how social life is conceived within a community. This does not mean negating divine power. It does mean reconsidering that power in relation to political structures, ritual actions, and the mediation of kingship. So all too briefly, I've tried to outline a historical line of thinking about political and sacred power, which either sanctions the domination of the weak by the powerful, the Wille zur Macht, as Nietzsche would put it, where vitality and its increase are the subject of social and individual life, or their developed conceptions that sought to limit the war of each against each, Hobbes, or conceive of the divine as the source and legitimation of power, Rousseau and St. Paul. However, by following Bella and other historians of religions, we can note that the perichoresis of sacred and political power is interrupted and challenged with the emergence of what we can call ethical power. It's very important to realize that two of the great founders of Western moral thinking, one was poisoned by the state for corrupting youth and creating new gods, and the other was crucified by the Roman state for basically the same charges. So the collusion of political and religious power is what I'm trying to focus on and show how ethical power can emerge out of that. Since I think that's the problem we're facing on our little planet right now, to be honest, if one sees what's going on. In other words, ethical power entails a second-order thinking about sacred and political power for the sake of orienting human life beyond the logic of might makes right, whether that logic is grounded in the deity or in nature. So Bella's point, and one made by other scholars as well, is that the axial breakthrough occurs when a community fosters second-order critical ethical thinking about its first-order beliefs about power. In terms of this lecture, the axial breakthrough happens when the ostensive naturalistic claim that power does and should dominate weakness, or that divine power rules through kingly power, when those are put into question. This happens, as we know, in Plato's Apology for Socrates against the charge that he was creating new gods and corrupting the youth. It is seen in ancient Israel when the great Hebrew prophets announce that God does not delight in cultic sacrifice, but in the care for the poor, the widow, the outcast within a vision of justice. Analogous breakthroughs are found in Islam, Buddhism, and what we call Hinduism. Of course, this does not mean that these religious traditions do not bear within themselves remnant strands of a pre-axial amoral outlook. They certainly do. It is this troubling fact that makes the use of religious sources in ethical arguments so contentious, insofar as different strands of a tradition can be accessed to warrant very different ethical and political outlooks. It's another thing we're seeing globally in terms of how the religions are being interpreted in different ways. And we have to see that those remnants of pre-axial forms of thought are, in fact, in all of our religions. Granting the ambiguity, then, of religious sources for ethics, it must nevertheless be said that for Christians, the axial breakthrough happens when Jesus teaches the love of neighbor through the parable of the Good Samaritan. More radically, when he teaches the love of the enemy. And also when, in 1 John 4:20, we read that whoever claims to love God but hates his brother is a liar. That is to say, the tight connection between the two love commands, to love God and to love the neighbor, is intensified in the command to love the enemy and to love as Jesus himself loved. And this places ethical limits on, interestingly enough, political power and divine power. What is lacking, however, in Bella's account, which I've elaborated in my own way, is how to conceive of the human ability to apprehend and to act on this axial breakthrough. That is, how is the ethical limit on the collusion of political and sacred power experienced within the structures of lived reality? Later, I will propose a conception of conscience to clarify that apprehension of and responsibility for the ethical limits on sacred and political power. The call of conscience, in other words, is the way we as moral beings live deeper than we think. Now notice, I have thus far tried to isolate some of the most ancient and widely accepted ideas about the relations among sacred political and moral power found in the legacy of Western thought. They have ranged from the assertion of power as its own warrant and aim, to the idea of the political sphere finding its source and limit in the divine, to finally the axial breakthrough about ethical power as a limit on both divine and political power. This account is, of course, all too brief and could be developed in much more detail. Likewise, we could trace contemporary arguments in so-called political theology. We could explore the importance and limits of human rights discourse, or even the scourge of political and religious terrorism in order to fill out my account. That filling out of my argument, though, is not possible since David has only given me 4 hours for this lecture. I want to thank you for that, David. Still, I hope you see I have identified some of the most basic endoxe about power and its limits. They may not be ones we want or like, but they are present in the history of thought and of society. It would then seem that what I have called the perichoresis of power arises within and is also important for ethical, political, and theological thought within the legacies, at least of this civilization, although there are analogs in others. For one reason or another, it has developed through time that the mutual relation and limits among sacred, political, and ethical power is ingredient to the very structure of our lived reality, and continues to do so even within our global age. We see the eruption of the pre-axial equation of might makes right every day in our newspapers, all around the world, and the attempts to counter those. Now, if this is a plausible case, then I can now start to lift the brackets a little bit and show what contemporary Christian theological ethics can and must contribute to thinking about power and its limits. Here, too, I think it's wise to begin with the endoxe of contemporary forms of Christian thought on this topic. I'm going to do so in terms of the American scene, but I know that there are parallels within the UK as well. With those remarks in hand, I will then finally lift the brackets completely and outline my own considered position. A glance over the landscape of contemporary Christian thinking about power reveals that two options dominate, almost to the level of boredom, if I may say, dominate the discussion that reaches far into the past of the Christian tradition. I'm referring, of course, to Christian pacifism, emblematically found in the U.S. in the work of Stanley Hauerwas, and Christian realism, associated originally with Reinhold Niebuhr. So we're back to Thucydides, right? We're back to the question where we began, and it's reappearing in our contemporary discourse. Reinhold Niebuhr's version of Christian realism is clear that within history, power must meet history, or power must meet power. Only the children of light, as he called them, imagine that moral suasion is sufficient to bend swords into plowshares. The Christian cannot and ought not hold to the idea that somehow Christian love will triumph in history. Christian love, that is the power of Christ acting in human lives, is the impossible possibility that stands judgment over the struggles for justice in time and will finally resolve itself only beyond tragedy, that is, beyond history. But in history, love cannot be the only ethical limit on political power. The ethical limit on politics is also through the discourse of justice, including justice in war. Love, then, is the regulative idea, we might say, for justice, an ideal never to be actualized in history, but which, nevertheless, enables Christians to make judgments about the work of justice and the extent to which it accords with God's will revealed in the life of Christ. Interestingly, Niebuhr associates his argument about the relevance of an impossible ethical ideal in his volume, An Interpretation of Christian Ethics, with prophetic religion, what I've called the axial breakthrough, and its perfect fruit in the ethics of Jesus. This claim, to use previous terms, of Christianity and prophetic Judaism is precisely the point of what we've called the axial breakthrough. As Niebuhr put it in that volume, quote, only a vital Christian faith renewing its youth in its prophetic origin is capable of dealing adequately with the moral and social problems of our age. Only such a faith can affirm the significance of temporal and mundane existence without capitulating unduly to the relativities of the temporal process, unquote. That is to say, only a Christian ethics rooted in the axial breakthrough of the Hebrew prophets can address the question about the use and limits of power without flights into mysticism or a dangerous utopianism or a vitalism that champions the powerful over the weak. Christian thought keeps in tension the historical and the transcendent, as well as the demands of justice and the reality of love. Insofar as Christian life is lived in that tension, religious and political power must be limited by the Christian ethical conception of the relationship between justice and love. Here again is a version of the perichoresis of power, but one that finds its normative core in the ethical relations among justice and redemptive love. Now, over the last several decades, versions of Christian pacifism have developed around the planet. One refrain in Stanley Hauerwas's lectures is that Reinhold Niebuhr is his sworn enemy. The reason for Hauerwas's hostility, presumably, is that Niebuhr found a way to sanction war in the name of the church. But for Hauerwas, the church is a people who have been formed by the story of God's action in Christ to be a people of peace in a world constantly at war. Indeed, it is the church that reveals the world to itself as a domain of conflict and violence. As he famously put it, the church does not have a social ethics, it is a social ethics. In this respect, the church is the vital limit to political power, and in the story of Christ is narrated the limit on religious appeals that would find divine sanction for war. We can notice here the axial breakthrough in that Christ and the church care for the poor, the outcast, and those who suffer by engrafting them into the church through the story of Christ. If Niebuhr's thought hinges on a tension between the historical and the transcendent, then Hauerwas's version of Christian ethics seeks to form the church through the virtues needed to live out the story of Christ. That story, Hauerwas argues, is unflinchingly committed to pacifism, even as it places the church against and yet in service of the world. What would alarm Niebuhr in Hauerwas's theology is the assumption that somehow Christians can escape both the negativities and the responsibilities of historical social life in order to form a peaceable kingdom, a counterworld to shared human social existence. But Hauerwas's point is not about the success or failure of the church to transform the world. Indeed, the root sin in his judgment is the attempt to live as if we, and not God, controlled the destiny of the world. The job of the church is simply to be the church. Hauerwas's claim, if I've understood him rightly, is that power in the form of control is the human problem. The Christian life must therefore disavow entanglements in networks of power, of self, of the nation, of God, and leave all else to the divine. Now, these two theologies, that is, Niebuhrian realism and Hauerwas's pacifism, articulate in various ways the perichoresis of power, as I've called it. Neither theologian, admittedly, is greatly concerned with the fine details of Trinitarian thought, and each of them, despite their grave differences, explores power and its limits from a decidedly ethical and Christian perspective. Further, despite their profound differences, Hauerwas and Niebuhr each seek to drive an ethical wedge between religious and political power and the fateful results of the collusion of those two titanic forces. They differ, of course, on the extent to which a Christian conception of power requires or disallows wielding political power. What we have seen is that the interrelations, the rotations or perichoresis of divine, ethical, and political power has taken different shape in the history of Western thought, including Christian thought. A brief examination of Niebuhr and Hauerwas showed, furthermore, that Christians still dispute the proper response to the fusion of political and divine power and what that response ethically entails. So then, do we end our inquiry with an irresolvable aporia? That is, an irresolvable tension or contradiction in the very heart of Christian existence and thought, where on the one hand political power is divinely sanctioned and yet on the other denied by Christ. If such an aporia exists, how might we identify it? And how might we render it productive rather than destructive through the endless clash between realists and pacifists in the church? While Niebuhr loved the idea of paradox, and so an aporia, I do not think that anyone is finally satisfied with a mere verbal resolution of this question. What then are we to do? I have intimated before that what is needed is a concept that can designate the differentiation of divine, political, and ethical power so that none of these is collapsed into the others. Undifferentiated power might have been functional in pre-modern societies, defined by one main source of value and intelligibility, say God or a king or nature. Yet in our global age, in which highly differentiated societies and their subsystems interact within the global flow of media, money, and people, it is hard to imagine, and in fact it would probably be cataclysmically destructive, to submit this global differentiation to one dominant form, even though there are folks right now who want to establish a caliphate that would do this, right? And there are Christians who make similar kinds of arguments. In fact, it would be destructive, on my reading, to these complex societies of which we are part. What is more destructive of complex societies than to submit their subsystems to the same values and codes of communication? We can see the destructiveness of this today in the U.S. in the flood of money into politics, but also in the reduction of media and education to economic rationality. In this situation, as Nicholas Luhmann has noted, quote, societal integration has to be left up to the reciprocal limitations on the movements of functional systems, unquote. That is to say, while pre-modern societies function through the unity of one substance, to borrow from Trinitarian language again, the functional coherence of contemporary differentiated societies is found in the reciprocal limitations, in the perichoresis of powerful subsystems. To limit the drive to dominance of the economy on this reading requires not weakening that social subsystem, but rather strengthening others that will limit the movement of economic forces, say by strengthening law, or media, or politics, or education. Put differently, what we need in ethics is a concept that can articulate the perichoresis of power within differentiated societies. At a social level, I have been suggesting that the idea of ethical power as a second-order thinking can serve this role with respect to political, moral, and religious power. Ethical power can be found in any other form of power as its media, because ethical power is the observation and evaluation of the working of a form of power from the perspective of not might makes right, but from the perspective of justice and responsibility, such that the mere maximization of power does not become the sole social agenda. In other words, ethical power takes the form of an axial breakthrough within the subsystems of differentiated societies, eliminating the dominance of any one power by other social forms of power. A balance of power argument. Is there a correlative conception to ethical power at the level of our lived reality as moral agents? Let me advance one more concluding step in my argument by addressing this question about agency. I've now removed the brackets completely. The best candidate to conceptualize ethical power as we experience it in our lives as agents is, I submit, the idea of conscience. Conscience, from the Latin conscientia, has meant many things in philosophical and theological thought, too many to examine here. However, one feature, conceived differently, is that it demarcates a doubleness or a differentiation within oneself. Self-knowledge is always with conscientia, with knowledge of another, and of the claim of the other on oneself. Immanuel Kant spoke about this strange otherness in terms of a person within one's own person. Martin Heidegger talked about the call of conscience as the call of the authentic self to the fallen self. The ancient Stoics spoke of this as a divine spark in the self. St. Paul thought it was knowledge of the law written on the heart, even of the Gentiles, as did John Calvin. Paul also worried about offending the conscience of others, even while Luther spoke of the terrified conscience and Martin Luther King Jr. called the conscience of a nation. Now, my point here is not to rehearse names, but rather to note that conscience usefully articulates a conception of our humanity in which we know ourselves in and with the claims of others on us that limits our exercise of power by the claim of what is good and right. The claim of conscience, we might say, is the axial breakthrough within a person's, an agent's life. Conscience is the term for human transcendence in which the claims of the integrity of life, one's own and that of others, is constitutive of oneself. In the religions, this means that conscience is a communication among and between realms, including the divine realm, without collapsing those into one or another. And this is why, on my account, the right to the freedom of conscience finds many of its historical roots in the freedom of religion. That is, the freedom to follow or to reject the claims of a religious or a political community. And that's an ethical power, to be able to resist either political or religious coercion. Insofar as that is the case, then freedom of conscience grasps the functional limitations of forms of power for the sake of the integrity of life. In other words, The claim of conscience makes responsibility the condition for people's specific identities. It therefore inverts the claims that specific identities are what are the condition for and limits on responsibility. Conscience, I'm suggesting, is a concept for the movement between forms of power as the human mode of moral being and the mode of being that communicates the claim of the integrity of life, one's own and that of others, in a way that constitutes a person's identity. It is the form ethical power takes in human life, and thereby casts human existence within the perichoresis of power dedicated to maximizing not the power of the powerful over the weak, but rather to what respects and enhances the integrity of life. In metaphorical terms, also derived from Trinitarian thinking, conscience is the imago Dei of the triune God active within the lived structures of human reality. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
In giving a platform for conscience in defining moral power, how do you engage with the conscience that speaks on behalf of the warrior's honor and revenge for a fallen soldier, or a harried conscience that is obsessed with certain addictions or whatever? How do you engage with conscience that seems to have a negative call?
Yeah, there's been a long tradition in the Christian faith that you should never violate your own conscience. So in an odd way, the warrior off to battle who's following his own conscience, one must respect that as a claim on that person, and then one must show how it's a mistaken claim. In order to do so, I've had to build in, and it's beyond the scope of this particular lecture, a theory of axiology, a theory of value that's wrapped up with this notion of the integrity of life that I've used. That an act of vengeance, an act of self-destruction through drugs, is in fact not respecting and enhancing the integrity of others' lives or one's own. It's demeaning and destroying. And therefore, the conscience would be terribly mistaken, even though the particular agent feels the claim of conscience on them. You see what I'm getting at? So one must grant, I don't think it's helpful to say that that person doesn't have the claim of conscience on them. It's just their conscience is mistaken. This is one of the reasons why the Roman Catholic Church has always understood the role of the magisterium to be the education of conscience, in order to address that kind of problem. Is that getting to your concern?
Can I have a follow-up?
Sure.
So what's the role of conscience here? Is it the basis on which you can make moral claims, or is it the voice of moral claims that sit behind conscience, so that conscience reveals moral reality?
It's, on my argument, this is a very important question, on my argument, it's the medium through which one's whole being apprehends the claim of the integrity of life on one and becomes constitutive of one's identity. Because I think one of the problems, I agree with Amartya Sen in this, I think one of the real dangers right now is that we're making identity the condition for responsibility, which means if someone doesn't share your identity, you don't have any obligations of responsibility to them. So I'm trying to make an argument that inverts this, and to show that the real claim of conscience is when the claim of the integrity of life, to respect and enhance that in oneself and in others, becomes constitutive of one's identity. That would mean I'm also talking about a kind of moral conversion from seeing oneself only as a particular type of person to realizing that one is claimed by the integrity of life. And that relativizes, in my judgment, all of our other identities. Because as far as I can see, saying that identity is the grounds of responsibility is a hair's breadth from saying might makes right. and I'm trying to undercut that at each point. Now, that's a very unpolitically correct thing to say, but that's the argument I'm making.
Right. Could I just ask who you are and where you're from? Oh, sorry, David Torrance, I'm from Cambridge.
Don't have to apologize. It's just a helpful thing as we begin to get to know each other to give your name and where you're from before you ask a question. So we've got about half an hour for some more questions. And don't forget what Jeremy said. If you'd prefer to ask a question via email or Twitter that he can feed in, that's fine too. So just catch my eye and indicate if you'd like to be added to the queue. Either.
Yes. Sure, why not? Okay.
Hugh McGrath, Site London. Professor Swiker, thank you very much. From a theological point of view, would it be fair to come back to you and say, actually, what you propose is a version of Kant saying, you know, the gospel is true as long as it conforms to the ethical, to the moral law? Or, in other words, again, from a theological point of view, why take the ethical as a meta power over including religious or divine power? What about swapping them around?
Right. Well, the easy answer is because I'm an ethicist. Second answer is I don't think we can get around Kant. If there's anyone in this room that wants to live in a world that does not acknowledge respect for persons, please stand up. So I get a little impatient with the notion that we can negate a position by associating with one of, I think, the strongest proponents of respect for persons. And in that sense, I suppose you would say, like many other Protestant theologians, Kant's a fellow traveler with me. Your question is fabulous because it takes us back to the beginning of Western ethics and the Euthyphro. The dialogue Euthyphro. This is called the Euthyphro problem. Whether something is good because the gods command it, or do the gods command it because it's good? Right? I'm trying to show that within the biblical traditions itself, there is a movement to placing limits on God's claim. When Jesus goes through and feeds his disciples on the Sabbath, he says, astonishingly, Sabbath was made for man, right? So that's why the 19th century theologians talked about Judaism and Christianity as forms of ethical monotheism. So it's not that I'm trying to pit the religious against the ethical. I'm trying to see how there can be a mutual testing within these three forms of power, religious and political. If there's any preference or preferencing of the ethical on my part, it's just because I look around the world right now and I see the collusion of political and religious power, and I see it doing an awful lot of destruction on our little planet. And I think it's important for, this is my own personal statement, I think it's important for those of us who inhabit religious traditions to show how they can be interpreted in their most humane ways. And that's what I'm trying to do through this kind of argument. Am I getting at your question?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's very, very big.
Sure.
What about distinguishing between religion on the one hand as a more organizational, organized religion sort of concept and God on the other hand?
Okay. How do you have access to this deity?
Sure.
How do you have access to this deity, right? And it, or one can make the Bardian argument, you know, that Christianity is not a religion, it's a faith. This gets very complicated if you're wanting to show the interactions between Christian churches and other realities. So I don't see, I understand your point, but I don't see how we're going to get there without having to deal with the muckiness and the wildness and the confusion of religious discourse. This is why I'm trying to take a religious concept, perichoresis, and exploit it hermeneutically. Yeah, good question. Uh-oh, here comes Susan.
Sorry, make to us first, and then Susan.
Actually, at the very end of Guido, I'm Victor Austin from New York. The end of Guido's question was, in a way, mine. I was wondering about if we could tease out the difference between religious power and divine power.
Okay, then the question we come is, what would be the principle of specific difference? That is, what would differentiate religious, God's power from religious power?
Well, it would be obviously a book-length project at least, but something like religious power is power that's claimed in God's name, but divine power is the power that's actually God's, which might come be understood as being in nature, of course, and might be understood as being in secular structure.
Then the question becomes, how do you distinguish this God from nature or secular structures? And I think, unless you want to go with Nietzsche and just say, well, God, you know, is this power and strength should dominate weakness, I think you're going to be pushed finally to some moral principle or moral idea to distinguish divine power from... I mean, this is a tricky question for those of us who work in the Christian tradition, because we assume a priori that the term God designates something good. But I'm trying to say, if you look historically and comparatively in the history of religions, that's not the case. And it's not the case the way Christians have oftentimes lived out their faith in God. And therefore, we have to get clear on what are the criteria we're using when we start appealing to this symbol or this idea, this word, whatever term one wants, right? And I think that's one of the tasks of the theological ethicist. You know,
I mean, in a naive way, though, one might turn to, Oliver Donovan's not naive, but he deals with what power is in the beginning of the Desire of the Nations, and has a sort of a construct of revelation.
But then we're back to the same problem.
I know, but it's an inescapable problem.
Exactly. And I'm trying to help folks realize we have to address this inescapable problems, and we'll have to make judgments about where we come down on it. I'm not sure that I could say comparatively that all people on this planet, the Christ is the desire of all nations on this planet. That's just an empirical question. I understand and I know his arguments to fortify that, but we would just start on this in very different ways. What I'm trying to say is not necessarily that everyone has to agree with me. It would be great if you all did. But I'm saying this is a problem that theological ethics must address. And one has to think through it as carefully as possible. Right? We can come to different answers, but we ought to at least address the problem.
Susan. Thank you. Thank you, Bill. Susan Parsons. Thank you. This has been very, very thought-provoking. Thank you very much. My question is along these same lines. And that is that there are, to me, significant aspects of Christian faith which I would struggle to justify morally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think primary amongst those would be the very phenomenon of redemption, which has been worked for us through death, mm-hmm. crucifixion, and resurrection. I can't fathom that in moral categories. And yet that is right in the middle of what a Christian would say is the power of God, mm-hmm. in the acts of God, mm-hmm. love. And that means that if I am committed to such a thing, I am committed to interactions with others on that basis, and that guides rather than any moral principles. So even those who are morally objectionable to me, I am obliged to forgive.
No.
And even those whom I would condemn according to your notion of responsibility, I am still obliged to love. And that, to me, places, as Guido was trying to emphasize, I think, it places one's faith above the moral thinking, the moral thought.
Now, notice what you've just done. You've started with the need to systematically differentiate religion from morality, right? Then you ask about the specific logic of the religious system about redemption, right? And then you wanted to show what that might mean for the moral life, correct? You follow me so far? In other words, you're dealing with the differentiation of claims. And I think that's fine. Yes, there are certain things we may want to say religiously that we don't want to say morally. What we have to develop is translation mechanisms between these, rather than, as I understood your concluding remarks, to subsume the moral into faith.
No,
I think that becomes, if you ask what is the social political implications of that, it could be very dangerous, if I may say so.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, I was personally, you know, I was a bit edgy when Prince Charles shook the hand of Mugabe at the ascension of Benedict XVI. So that, to me, I thought, how can you do that from a founding country, a democratic country, to treat this man with that sort of respect? And yet, that seems to me to be what is required of a person of faith. So what I think I'm saying is, rather than morals being subsumed, the moral principles are ordered to the reality of faith, rather than faith being ordered to the moral principle.
Well,
I don't have to subsume that. I don't have to say that faith becomes a dominant, but it is that to which the moral life relates and is ultimately directed.
Right.
We
just disagree. I'm with Socrates, you're with Euthyphro. That's basically the division. And I'm trying to show that I can make an argument that is still in the Christian tradition, since many of the critics of this kind of position want to exclude, right? But in fact, there's a long tradition that goes back to Jesus himself that is placing limits on divine claims, right? Part of what's going on in the Good Samaritan story is to show that the Jewish ritual practices of the Pharisees and so on are not actually functioning the way they should, right? So we disagree on this point. My gambit is to try to show that the argument I'm making cannot be so easily dismissed by saying, well, that's not really religious. No, in fact, it is religious, and it has a very deep and long pedigree. But it's the kinds of decisions we have to make as ethicists, all and theologians, all of us. So thanks. Thanks.
Robert Gascoigne, Australian Catholic University. Thanks very much for your paper. I think you've very persuasively and powerfully argued that the ethical and the religious should not be collapsed into each other. But I just want to ask the question, to what extent do you think the ethical can remain strong without some kind of nourishment from religious or metaphysical sources? For example, if we think of evolutionary reductionism, can the ethical remain in that worldview?
This is why I quoted Whitehead. In fact, the only tool we have as ethicists is words. We don't have guns. We don't have sacred rites. We have the most feeble of human tools. This is the significance of the Socratic dialogue. The only tool he has, or Jesus' teaching. They're not, and so moral claims, as I noted, are weak in terms of how they can be institutionalized. I then tried to show how that weakness can become helpful when it's working within the interaction of these other differentiated powers. Right? I'm not saying that the ethical can somehow remove itself completely from the political and the religious. Rather, it is a way of thinking about and inhabiting those powers with respect to a claim about the limits of those systems of power, right? I think we should take it very, very seriously that ethics, moral claims of themselves, are extraordinarily weak, right? Try making an argument to the U.S. government about the use of military weapons on purely moral grounds. So I'm trying to think again about how we could admit the constitutive weakness, if I can put it that way, of moral claims, and that our only medium of reflection is through language and persuasion. right, rather than coercion. How nonetheless we might interact with power centers in our societies to help draw some limits within internal to them. I mean, that's part of the reason why I like this language of the perichoresis, because you're trying to think about the rotation among these. Is that getting to your concern, which is a real powerful one?
Yes, but it seems to me that there are very strong theological affinities there, because, as you say, in one sense, ethics is very weak. And that links with the Christian sense of the vulnerability of Christ.
Yeah, power made perfect in weakness.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
But that's
collapsed into each other, but haven't finished.
Right. So then the fact, I mean, this is great. The fact that you're seeing this has shown, if I can be prideful for a moment, that the hermeneutic of the lecture provides a way into reading Christian symbol systems, which is what I was trying to do. Right. So it gives us a different way to understand, well, maybe when Jesus says power made perfect in weakness, there's something more profound about that than simply, you know, the narration of his actions. Am I making sense?
Okay.
Yeah.
David at the front. You're on the queue, David.
David Robinson, Edinburgh. I had a question about, you talked about access to knowledge, and I wonder if you could elaborate on how an ethicist has access to the criterion integrity of life, especially, I think, as this relates to how you've challenged claims based on identity. Mm-hmm. For responsibility. So to take an example, from the U.S., the Black Lives Matter campaign, which is an identity claim of a sort, a protest that says there is no socio-ethical integrity here,
mm-hmm.
It seems to me to be exposing might makes right claim
mm-hmm.
rather
yeah,
than
absolutely.
Being a hair's breadth.
Absolutely.
So I wonder if you could speak a bit to that way in which the claim of integrity of life is often a privileged claim or often without an identity protest coming against it. We don't see how narrow that integrity is.
Yeah, well, we need to, if we can for a moment, slow down and unpack some concepts. I think the integrity of life is the dynamic of living things that seek to integrate, to bring together, in humans, 5, in all other living things, 4 levels and types of goods, which I call bodily goods, social goods, reflexive goods, goods of locality, and then finally the moral good. Okay? We can try it this way. How many people sitting in this room right now want to have their lives decompose such that you die physically or emotionally you're stricken and can no longer understand or communicate, or you find out that all of your friends have deserted you? In other words, we're always trying to integrate our lives with respect to these different levels of goods. And I think life simply is the power of that integration. Because if you take away that power, the thing dissipates and dies. Okay? So when I say respect and enhance the integrity of life, I'm saying 2 things. One, I'm saying respect and enhance how a community or an individual uniquely integrates those goods important for their continued flourishing. And I'm also saying respect and enhance that capacity to integrate those things. Now, the legacy of racism is precisely the attempt to destroy and demean the integrity of people's lives, right? On different levels. So racism itself can be seen as an absolute affront to what I call the reflexive good, the goods of meaning, right, as well as bodily goods, the disruption of families. So it's destructive of the integrity of social life, social goods. So what I'm trying to do is to provide a framework within which we can then start dealing with particular cases, right? To have that claim of another person's, the integrity of their life or another community on oneself, the claim of conscience, so deeply that it constitutes your own identity and may require a moral conversion is precisely what I would see going on in something like this campaign. Right? Yes, Black Lives Matter. All lives matter. and the systematic attempt to demean and destroy the integration of goods necessary for a community to exist is what I would call evil. Am I getting to your concern? So integrity for me isn't a privilege term. It's what we're all doing all the time. Right? We're always constantly integrating our lives in various ways. You all have made the decision, you may be regretting it right now, to come and hear me lecture this afternoon. That was with respect to the integration of your reflexive life, the lives of meaning and understanding. It means you've had to give up something, although we did have some great treats, so we did deal with social and bodily goods before coming up here. But we're constantly integrating things. That's just what it means to be alive on my account.
Yeah? Eric, would like to lend
it. Yeah, Eric Wolverston, a retired URC minister. But for the first 25 years of my career, I was an academic teaching history and politics.
Oh, good.
So as in that capacity, of course, power was a central theme for almost everything that you did or studied.
Yeah.
So I was particularly keen on coming to this conference.
I hope I haven't disappointed you too much.
A splendid start off. When you, near the beginning, said there was this debate between powers and media, right from the beginning of my academic study, I was also, as an undergraduate, which I started in 1950, in the heyday of the old student Christian movement. In one of their early meetings, I was introduced to Niebuhr and read his books at the same time as the study of history. Mm-hmm. And Christian realism was one which enormously impressed me. Mm-hmm. So very clearly I've always been on that side of the debate, as it were. Mm-hmm. And recently, a member of this society, Nigel Bigger, of course, has added things on that side. Mm-hmm. And I was delighted to read a piece he had in the Times recently talking about the current Labour Party leadership contest, in which he denounced what he saw as Corbyn, the far-left candidate's completely ludicrous view of the nature of power. Mm-hmm. Particularly in ways commented on various quite despicable regimes. And I think that showed the stand which, as Christians, we need to take. Because there are times you quite rightly criticise might is right, but sometimes there are surely situations where the right can only be defended by might.
Sure, but that's not meaning that power is then rendered morally ambiguous. Unambiguous. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. In my understanding... Please, I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
No, that's all right. I think there are times when you have to come down, as it were.
Sure.
And say, we've got to use might. When I was studying a book on interwar pacifism, a quotation that particularly impressed me was a man who, in the 20s, had been caught up in the very powerful pacifist sentiment of that period, but changed his position as totalitarianism, particularly Hitler, gathered strength.
I'm not making a pacifistic argument.
No, I know that. This man said, I'm quite entitled to say for myself, I'd rather end up in a concentration camp than take up arms, but I'm not entitled to say it when I know there are hosts of other people who certainly wouldn't make that choice.
Right.
So he changed his position.
Right. So the claim I made just before that conscience is the medium through which the one has the claim to respect and enhance the integrity of life, that means in others. And sometimes we have to defend that. I would agree with that. I'm just trying to develop Niebuhr's position as a form of political realism. But there are two other types of realism I'm dealing with, what are called moral realism and theological realism. And I'm not sure Robin Levin has done a good job filling that out. I'm not sure that Niebuhr actually kept all three going at the same time. But yes, we have to make prudential and casuistic judgments about particular cases. And I'm quite willing myself to say that there's arguments and moments when we should engage in humanitarian intervention because people's lives are being demeaned and destroyed. That's right.
Yeah. Approaching the end of our time, I've got David and Helen on the queue.
David Cunningham, Hope College. I want to talk a little bit and ask you about the analogy with perichoresis. And I understand the caveats that you made at the beginning, but here's my question. I see the relationship between the Trinitarian claims about perichoresis. There, we're talking about three persons, but they have a similarity in common. They're all God. And we have the three kinds of power you're talking about. They have a similarity in character.
Yes.
They're all forms of power. The problem, or the question that I'd like you to address is that in the Trinitarian case, we know something about the thing that they all are. That is God. That's God has a character. It has quality. This being has certain qualities that we know, or depending on our particular theological assumptions, have been revealed to us, or that has some kind of character. We can say what this God is. And what I'm trying to figure out is what the equivalent of that is in your analogy. What is the thing that power always is, no matter whether it's political, divine, or ethical power? I think if I could get a clearer sense of that, I would have a better sense of how it is possible for these three to interact.
Right.
I think the reason that I'm having trouble with that is I'm not sure what the basis of similarity is that allows the interaction.
Right.
So I wonder if you will.
I stipulated at the very beginning a definition of power as the capacity to respond to create, or to shape reality. So what all three, political, moral, and religious power, share are those dynamics, right? And I use the example, some process theologians do this, that want to say God is maximally responsive to all things and therefore is all-powerful, right? If you increase the capacity to respond to things, like right now, I could completely divest myself of intellectual power by not being able to respond to your question. Right. So if we can increase the ability of something to respond to reality, that's an increase in power. If we increase the capacity to shape or to create realities, that's an increase in power. So what they all share is that rather formal, stipulated definition of power. I use
an ability, basically. A capacity, maybe.
Right, but it's always correlate to something. So it's not just self-referential. It's right. In relation to reality.
I understand that. In terms of capacity, I guess what I'm asking about is asking for something a little stronger, which you don't want to give, I understand. This is why I think I'm wondering whether the parallel really holds up, because in the case of the Trinitarian perichoresis, we know more than just about a capacity, right? We know about a character. And I think if we try to give any kind of character to the power that these all share, then this analogy is going to fall apart because there's a lot that they don't share.
Yeah, this is why I noted the three caveats at beginning.
Right.
And also, and also the fact that I'm talking about an analogy.
Sure.
And an analogy is a similarity in difference.
Right. I'm just trying to spot where
the difference would be precisely on what you're suggesting. And this could get very complicated, unless one were to say that what we know most basically about God is that God is love. And then I think you might be very close to power discourse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we've just got time for a final question from Helen.
Ah, hi.
I'm a Christian Church of England. If I can squeeze in two very, very short questions. Clarification, really. Listening to you talk about integration and conscience just now, I started to feel that we were heading towards a capacity definition of what it means to be human.
No.
Which made me wonder whether a two-year-old who really has nothing that could be called a worthwhile conscience is someone that has to be treated as a human in the exercise of power over them, and how someone so young or someone who has lost capacity otherwise fits into that argument you're making about conscience. The other is around the hesitation I think I heard about spotting revelation. And to what extent that then means we can't see the difference between religious and political power, whether that simply becomes the power of two different forms of institution, but where the differences between them are accidental rather than relating to anything we can discern more reliably, even if in a rational way.
Okay, very good. Your first question is absolutely important. It's why I disagree with, for instance, a Nussbaum or a Sen's arguments in capabilities theory. I also don't draw on languages about practices. In the response to this gentleman up here, I talked about human beings have basic needs that are integrated, right? That is to start with a picture of human beings having worth in their vulnerability, in the fact that we are needy, right? And so I would want to stay away from any kind of position that would say that the worth of a human being is dependent upon maximizing their capacities. Because then we're back to a power argument again that I want to avoid. So you're absolutely right, okay? I think in the situation you're talking about, the claim of conscience would be to perceive in the child this integration of needs, and therefore one must respect and enhance that, right? The second point, if I understood it, is about what's the relationship between, or what's the principle of difference between religion and politics? Is that, yeah?
If you're being cautious about revelation, as I understood you to be.
Right. Well, revelation for me is the self-giving of the divine being itself. It's not information. It is rather an empowerment that enables human beings to live in certain ways. For Christians, it would be able to live in discipleship to Jesus, right? It's not the inner workings of the Trinity. It's not the I don't see revelation as communication of doctrines. That's a human enterprise we engage in to try to make sense of the religious life. So then the question becomes is, what's the difference between a religious experience of power and a political experience of power? And it has to do with, in my judgment, that which you're trying to connect with. I think religion is about, it's about many things, but at core, it's about connecting to the sacred. And politics is not about connecting with the sacred. It's about connecting with political power and authority. Now, when those two become fused, so that we start thinking we're connecting with the sacred, if we're connecting with political power, then we've got some real dangers, you see. So you're pushing on the definition of religion, which I have a very convoluted one I could go through if you want. But at the core of it, with respect to this, is what are you trying to connect to? Are you trying to connect to the divine? Are you trying to connect to the political authorities? Or, morally, are you trying to connect to the integrity of life?
So do you not see a vocation relating to the good in politics?
Oh, no. I think politics is a very necessary thing. It's just not the only thing. Right. Absolutely. It's very necessary. We are social beings. We have to order our lives together. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. We've reached the end of our time. So, Bill, I'm hugely grateful to you for making clear our proposal of how we're going to relate religion, ethics, politics, and power. And I think continuing to think about options for that as we go through the conference will be hugely helpful. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you all. Thank you all. Thank you for your generosity.